Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. With the world's largest population, formidable natural resources, a communist government, and a roaring capitalist economy, China is a country full of challenges, possibilities, and stark contrasts. So what does China want? And how do the aspirations of the Chinese people correspond or conflict with the intentions of the autocratic Chinese Communist Party? Ross Terrell is a fellow at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard University. He's in town to speak about these questions at an event this evening sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Ross, welcome to Think.
Lovely to be here, Chris. Thank you.
You have said quite simply, China wants to be the hegemon. Is that of Asia, of the entire world?
Well, first of all, China wants to recover from certain things in the past. And as you say, they're a huge country, an enormous population, much of it poor, and they have borders with 14 countries. So they want to keep the ship steady. That's a sincere aim. But because of their illustrious past as a civilization, I do think there is an expectation that they should be second to none. And, of course, this depends on power. The Chinese leaders are authoritarian, but they're rather rational authoritarians. I mean, look around the world at all the irrational ones. And the Chinese know how to count the numbers, and they realize that they are well behind the United States in economic power and power to project themselves militarily abroad. So it's an uncertain question whether they expect to push us aside as a global power. There's a lot of questions about whether they could do that. A leading global power needs a message, for example. And the US has a kind of a message in our support for democracy and free markets. China used to have a message, Maoism, but then they buried that message at home, let alone wanting to push it anymore internationally. So there are many questions about global supremacy, but I think in Asia there are signs that they are trying to clip our wings a bit.
What is the relationship that modern Chinese have to the legacy of Mao? You had Jiang Zemin famously saying, well, Mao was 70% right and 30% wrong.
Deng Xiaoping. Oh. You're asking a very biased person. My own biography of Mao is at the moment a big bestseller in Chinese language in Beijing and Shanghai. So why are young Chinese reading about him? Because, as you say, the post-Mao leadership declared that he made serious errors. One reason is that there's a Chinese tradition of biography that it's about a type rather than an individual. So he's either going to be a monster or he's going to be a hero, and you read the biography for lessons for yourself to be virtuous. And our Western tradition of biography, of course, is more nuanced. We believe that we have to get the facts right, and that human nature being what it is, most people are some kind of mixture. And a lot of Chinese have written to me saying they were fascinated with the idea of thinking of Mao as a man and his personal relationships, his father. He didn't like at all and wanted him to be a farmer, and Mao wanted to read books, and they clashed on virtually everything. Then, fascinatingly enough, at the end of his life, Mao started to emulate his father. His father had been in the army, so Mao said to the Red Guards in the Cultural Revolution, let's learn from the military, and everyone wore military garments. You may remember that time. So I think ordinary Chinese people have a cultural interest. It's not really political. Mao has entered the pantheon of folklore. They have other people who have done this. The Yellow Emperor, a very, very long time ago. And then there are the religious figures, the Goddess of Mercy. When the floods hit the Yangtze River, farmers hold pictures of the Goddess of Mercy, hoping it will push the floodwaters back. Now they sometimes hold pictures of Mao Zedong as well.
As brilliant a scholar as you are, Ross, it's telling that, you, a U.S.-living, Australian-born writer, have the best-selling biography of Mao in China.
Well, it pleases me, I must say. And the reviews said, well, he tells stories and yet he keeps his eye on history and what was happening. Of course, that's exactly what one aims to do in a biography. But you do have to have some feeling for the drama of the person. I've written other biographies, including one of his wife, which I enjoyed even more because she was definitely a bit of a villain, but there were reasons for it because she was a victim too. A terrible father who beat her, and she went into the theatre in Shanghai in the 30s, and she had to compromise to get roles. She had to sleep with producers if she wanted parts. And so when she married Mao and got power, alas, she started throwing her weight around the way she'd had weight thrown around against her earlier. It's just one of these human tragedies. But I did have a sense of that she was understandable, and that when in the Cultural Revolution she became very left-wing and radical. I said in the book I think she was practicing revenge. And when she addressed the crowds of Red Guards in Beijing, I said, well, she thinks she's addressing audiences in the Shanghai theatre. So in the sense that one tries to empathise with them, it doesn't mean whitewash them. But in a biography, you have to get some feel for what's going on. And apparently, that's what some Chinese think about the Mao book now.
Ross Terrell is my guest. He's a fellow with the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard University. He's in town to speak about what China wants at an address this evening at the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. That's taking place at the Crow Collection of Asian Art at 6 tonight. If you'd like to join us this afternoon, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You were in China when the earthquake happened.
I was. I didn't go for the earthquake, but the earthquake affected everything from that memorable afternoon, May 12.
And then a week later, at the traditional time in Chinese culture when a death would sort of be commemorated for the first time, you observed something that you perhaps never expected.
Well, I'm considered somewhat critical of the Chinese party state system. I think it's going to be very difficult for a communist party to go on ruling a country that's changed so much with a new economy, a new society, lines out to the world in trade and in culture. But I did feel during the earthquake that there was a unity of feeling between the government and the people, and it did affect me. I went down to Sichuan province on other matters, and there was this moment of silence for 3 minutes. The whole nation came to a stop, and I was in a vehicle, and it stopped. The driver got out. All the cars stopped, and people came out and clasped their hands in front of them. Occasionally, you'd hear a baby crying, but otherwise it was silence. Now, the Chinese are not the most disciplined people in the world, not like the Japanese, for instance, but it was a most impressive show. And the occasion, as you mentioned, of the period since the tragedy is part of a tradition in Chinese society. It's not a tradition in communist history or the Chinese Communist Party history. So I did feel that state and society were on the same page. It doesn't always happen, because when the state declares something, like for the funeral of Mao, the people may or may not be interested. And when society erupts in a demonstration, as at the Tiananmen in 1989, the state hides behind closed doors until they're ready to send out the tanks. In other words, state and society tend to be on a different page. But during the earthquake, I had the opposite sense. Chinese TV, which doesn't like live coverage because they have to have the censors telling them what to do, and there's all sorts of other problems for them, they covered the Sichuan situation live, day after day. And while a lot of the interviews were probably delayed and the answers were sifted, the reporter's own behavior was generally not. And it was absolutely fascinating to me to see the Chinese media being stretched toward normalcy by the event.
Does that reflect a change in the Chinese people, do you think, or a change in the Chinese Communist Party to permit this?
Good question. I think it comes from below. And a former student of mine, who's now a very successful businessman, he had a branch of his business destroyed by the earthquake in Sichuan. His headquarters are in Shenzhen, the enclave near Hong Kong. And they raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for the earthquake. And he said to me before I left China, "We have money now." And because business is flourishing, because people can make money independent of whether they're good communists or not, civil society, as we call it, jumped in and came to the aid of the victims of the earthquake. And the state was a bystander at times. Now, the military was providing logistics, but society had stepped in. And yes, I think the new economic muscle of China and the extent to which people feel that they can carve out their lives for themselves. This may sound very simple-minded to you, but for many years under Mao, you couldn't carve out your life for yourself. You graduated from college, if you were lucky to get to college, and you were given a job, just like that, a piece of paper. No choice. Do I want to teach? Do I want to be an actor, or do I want to do this? So now people are busy making their own lives. And once you do that, after a while, you start thinking your own thoughts.
So it's inevitable that the change will come?
I think the balance is moving toward the new economy and the new society getting ever stronger. And the state adjusting, yes, sometimes adjusting very well. They joined the World Trade Organization a few years ago. They compromised because they need the American market, so they have to obey all these rules. You can see the pressures on them. But you can also see a certain rationality in their response to the pressures.
Ross Terrell is my guest. He is a fellow at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard. We're talking about what China wants for the 21st century. We'll be back in just a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. After the break, we will talk about China and the Olympics and what the world's attention might change.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ross Terrell. He's a fellow at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard and the author of multiple books, including The New Chinese Empire. He'll be addressing the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 6 at the Crow Collection of Asian Art in downtown Dallas. You can find information about that at dfwworld.org. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Ross, what are the chances in your estimation for somebody like a Chinese Gorbachev, someone who would remain a loyal communist but was nevertheless willing to really open things up?
Inevitable. But you wisely said a Chinese Gorbachev, or we might jump ahead and say a Chinese Yeltsin, who was the logical next step after Gorbachev. In other words, your comment points to the fact that the drama will occur within the Communist Party for the most part. And change can come in these systems in three ways. An international challenge can sweep a government to its feet or sweep it away. Uprisings from below, farmers' revolts, students, or a split within the Communist Party itself where there's a feeling of facing two roads. In China, it could be, look, without the Leninist system, we can't hold this, what I call, empire together. We've got to stick with Communist one-party rule or the vast realm of China with its 1.3 billion people is not going to hold together. And the other part of the party may say, look, you can't separate economic freedom and political freedom forever. We've done it for 25 years and we've been successful, but there is a logic about the interaction of economics and politics, and we'll have to make political changes, which they all know would mean some kind of political competition where people have a choice. And in that context, someone may jump up in the communist leadership and say, I'm no longer a communist. Or they may say, the Chinese Communist Party should now just be called the Chinese Party. Or, look, we've got a big section of our people who believe in social democracy. And couldn't we formalize their position and the Leninist position? I think it will happen, but of course it will happen in a Chinese way. There are many reasons why the Chinese will be cautious. They learned some lessons from the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was a tremendous shock to them because they saw not only the end of the monopoly of power of a communist party, but they saw the breakup. They saw Georgia leave, Ukraine leave, Latvia, Lithuania say bye-bye to Moscow, and three republics on their own borders, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan, which had been simply portions of the Soviet Union, suddenly became sovereign neighbors. So, of course, they learned lessons from that, and they won't do things exactly that way.
China has tried to keep the outlying provinces, which have a lot of different ethnic minorities, people don't think about this, other than Han Chinese, they have tried to keep them coherent by sending in these floods of Han Chinese settlers to the provinces. Has that worked to sort of unify the culture?
It has worked to some degree because it's buttressed by economic success. That's to say the Chinese Han race, as you correctly call them, they go out to the Muslim area of Xinjiang, and they do well from cotton or from oil or whatever. And the Uyghurs, the Muslim people, are not as prosperous, but they are doing better than they were doing before too. So the population proportion between the non-Chinese and the Chinese in all these areas. The three big ones are Xinjiang, the Muslim area, next to Central Asia, to its south, Tibet, which is Buddhist, and then to the north, the southern part of Mongolia. The northern part of Mongolia being the separate sovereign state of the Republic of Mongolia. All three of these areas represent major civilizations in history. The Turkic peoples in Xinjiang, who speak a Turkish language and have the Islam, the Tibetans, and the Mongolians. So the Chinese tactic that you mention of diluting them with Han people and seducing them with economic progress, it may work. It's not comparable to the Soviet case because the Soviet Union was only 50% Russian and China's about 91% Han. It's a fairly big difference. On the other hand, the amount of territory in China that's traditionally non-Chinese is huge. It's half the country. So if you draw a line north to south, equidistant from the eastern and western borders of China, all to the west of that line was historically not Chinese at all. And most of the Chinese dynasties did not rule it. The last Chinese dynasty, the Qing, 1644 to 1911, doubled the size of the previous Ming dynasty. And so we come to think that the People's Republic of China today is what China's always been. Well, no, it hasn't. And they may pull it off, Chris, but the Russians will have a say in it too. If the Russians recover their priorities and their national strength, as they appear to be doing with all their oil revenues, and if they pay as much attention to Central Asia, the three countries I mentioned, Kazakhstan and the others, as they now pay to Georgia and Ukraine and Belarus, and with the presumption that these people should still look to Moscow, well, the country that would feel the pressure of that is China, because China's had something of a free ride with these republics, with Moscow preoccupied with other things and not enjoying the economic success of China. That's to some extent come to an end.
The Georgians have been disappointed that the U.S. hasn't come instantly to their aid in their fight with Russia. I'm wondering about Taiwan, because since 1972, the U.S. has, by all accounts, by many accounts, sort of accepted the one China policy, and yet Taiwan is a democracy and we support its efforts. If China were to go into Taiwan, if I'm correct, we have never promised that we would intervene militarily.
The last point, not quite true. We have promised, and Mr. Bush has reiterated, that we would do whatever it takes to enable Taiwan to successfully defend itself. It's true we no longer have a security treaty that dated from 1954 and ended after the full opening with Beijing, but the guarantee to Taiwan embodied in American law through the Taiwan Relations Act is pretty strong. Chris, I think the key to this point is what happens beforehand, not what happens after an attack. If you play your cards correctly beforehand, there won't be an attack. And this is the story of Taiwan. We made a great big mistake in 1950 when President Truman and Secretary of State Acheson mentioned that Korea was not within the defense parameter of the United States. And Stalin, in cahoots with Kim Il-sung, the North Korean dictator, saw their opportunity. China was drawn in a little reluctantly. And China then had to face the fact that Douglas MacArthur persuaded Truman to move the 7th Fleet down into the Taiwan Strait. And Truman's attitude change, not only to Korea, but to Taiwan. And then soon after, we had this security treaty. And China simply could not go ahead with its plan that was already on the books in 1950. They were making preparations. They couldn't go ahead with it. So we have deterred war in the Taiwan Strait by being strong. And in the meantime, China's turned to economic development. Taiwan's been a big success as a capitalist economy. And we've had 50 or 60 years of astonishing, successful, peaceful coexistence. We should salute that and ask why. And if America was suddenly to be weak or give the wrong signals, it might come to an end. So I think everything depends on deterrence. My old teacher, Henry Kissinger at Harvard, he left us all with the feeling that equilibrium can be a very moral concept, because if it keeps the incentive to make war down, it keeps the peace. And we have an equilibrium in East Asia for many reasons, one of which I've mentioned.
Do you worry that economic prosperity in China also creates a sort of disincentive for the people of China to rise up and demand their rights?
Yes, I worry that the middle class has sort of been bought off by the regime. There's a tacit agreement. You can make money, but don't talk politics. And it's not the most noble alliance in the world. And there's a vacuum of values, Chris. This is a civilization that for 2,500 years has lived by ideas, often those of Confucius and Mencius, and sometimes of Buddhism and of the Taoist philosophers, Lao Tzu, who believed in closeness to nature and a kind of passivity. And now they have an official political doctrine, Marxism-Leninism, which they don't really believe in anymore, but they're not actually allowed to embrace a full-blooded alternative. It's a rather curious situation for a civilization as talented and as given to as much philosophic contribution to the world as China has.
So it's essentially sort of at this point, there's no ideology behind what remains within the Communist Party, the Chinese Communist
Party. It's pretty eclectic. They borrow here, they borrow there. The idea of exporting revolution was very big under Mao, and people like Che Guevara in Latin America and Pol Pot in Cambodia, not to speak of the French professors in Paris, they all thought Maoism was the wave of the future. And China said the countryside of the world, meaning the third world, is going to surround the cities of the world, meaning us, just the way the Chinese peasants surrounded the Chinese cities and took over in 1949. Well, it all came crashing down, and now China is importing management strategy. The Chinese bookshops are full of books about American businessmen, Jack Welch's memoir, Lee Iacocca's, and they're looking for ideas, and of course joining the WTO and the Asian Development Bank and many other institutions. So this is good for the international community. Whether if you and I were not sitting here in Dallas today, but we were Chinese saying, you know, what's the future of our culture? What's the future of our values? It might be a much more complicated question.
We have an email from Greg in Lancaster who asks, why should we care what China wants? China wants to be a world power, but they cheat on everything to gain advantage in a competitive environment. We should not care what China wants, but refuse entry into trade and sport until China agrees to do and actually does play by the same rules that other industrialized and civilized nations do.
Well, it's not either or, Greg, because we are on the same planet and we are interdependent in some ways, and environmental and refugee questions are making that more pronounced. But at the same time, we influence each other. And some of the shortcomings you mentioned have been mitigated in China precisely by American pressure. And I think if American business, for instance, picked up its installations and left China, I think that that pressure to liberalize China would be left, would be lost. And if the 80 or 90,000 Chinese students on our campuses were told to go home, I think we would be shooting ourselves in the foot, to use a Chinese expression, because tomorrow's Chinese elite are being educated in Texas, Massachusetts, New York today. That's a tremendous force for China and America to not only understand each other better, but for the values that we regard as central to a free society to have more influence in China. So I say engage, but keep an equilibrium so that China is not tempted to take reckless actions, because they know that the US and Japan, especially in East Asia, are holding a kind of equilibrium which makes it unattractive for them to suddenly try and become number one.
Ross Terrell is with us. He's a fellow at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard University. He has written multiple books, including The New Chinese Empire. He'll be addressing the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at 6 at the Crow Collection of Asian Art. You can find more about that at dfwworld.org. We'll be back to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can do it by phone, 1-800-933-5372.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ross Terrell. He's a fellow at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard. He's in town to speak about what China wants to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. He's written several books, including The New Chinese Empire. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Our visions right now of China are deeply colored by Olympic coverage and the sort of build-up to this. You have said the Olympics would display China, but certainly not change it. Do you think that the reports emerging from the Games even give an accurate picture of China today?
Well, the sports events, fortunately, have taken over in the last week or so, and that's been a delightful change from the weeks and months of speculation. This is in the nature of the problem the media has. I mean, look at the presidential campaign. Most of the coverage is speculation. We're waiting for this, we're waiting for that. And the coverage of the Olympics was likewise. I mean, think of all the articles we all read about pollution, and then it turned out the air was pretty clear. You can't blame the reporters for covering all these possibilities. But the basic answer to your question is that the China, the party state that's put on an excellent event and a wonderful opening ceremony, is the other side of the coin from the China state that's repressive. It's their way of doing things to push the beggars away and the disabled and lock up the Falun Gong religious people for the event, because that's what they think order consists of. That's what they think it means to be efficient and to be hospitable to the foreign world. So that's what I really mean by saying it displays China rather than it changes it. In the short term, it's been pretty tough for a lot of Chinese who are not trusted by the government. In the longer term, I think the story might be different, because China, including the officials, have had to rub shoulders with the world and compromise in some limited respects with the world, as on few previous occasions. The WTO negotiations that I mentioned was one case in point, but the Olympics has been a major one, and I think it does help a little bit for China to have a sense that there are many ways of doing things, and most of the major countries in the world are now democracies, and it makes them think.
You have firsthand experience on multiple occasions with the way that China perceives order and how it should be carried out. Not only were you in Beijing at Tiananmen, but you, a couple years later, were arrested in China and forced to write a false confession. Did those experiences change your ability to objectively look at the Chinese government and the Chinese people and look at its strengths and flaws and potential for success?
It may be so. I think other people have to judge that. When I give my opinions or the arguments in the new Chinese Empire, they must stand or fall by the evidence that I present. The emotional experience was not overwhelming. After all, I didn't suffer. I was simply grabbed and escorted away and put on a plane for Hong Kong. So it wasn't a horrible experience the way people, Chinese people who are imprisoned have, or who are deprived of their rights, or sometimes if one member of a family in China commits a transgression, other members of the family are persecuted, a very unpleasant holdover from Chinese traditional law. But if the lesson of Tiananmen and what happened, I joined in China with a student who'd been a leader at Tiananmen. He was then studying in Boston University, and I was helping to guide him in his studies. And I hooked up with him, and I was accused of trying to bring democratic ideas to China and trying to split the Chinese nation. I think that kind of accusation actually only shows how backward the Chinese Communist Party, at least at that point in time, were in their thinking about the modern world. By the way, I don't think they would do that again. I get visas to China all the time, and the unfortunate thing is I have to be careful that I don't incriminate Chinese who might get into trouble if they tell me things they shouldn't tell me. That's the most unpleasant aspect of the whole business of having to be a critic of China sometimes. But I think now the Chinese government probably realizes it would be counterproductive to escort me out of China, because there'd be a bigger fuss. There was a big fuss in 92, there'd be a bigger fuss. And as with some of these gaffes during the Olympic Games, it just isn't good for the reputation of a modernizing country that says repeatedly that they want to be part of the international community, and they're heading at their own speed for more democracy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to David in Dallas. Hello, David.
Hi. I just wanted to comment I was in China for a little over 3 months in 87. The two major thoughts I came away with were that traditionally and culturally and socially at that time, the Chinese attitude in business and personal relations and even social and business relation was whatever you can get away with to get ahead, you do. That was my impression of the Chinese way of doing things. And the other was, at that time in 87, they wouldn't allow as many people out of the country. And I thought that was kind of stupid because my attitude was if they let as many Chinese out into the world as they will, they will eventually take over. And I wanted to know what your comments are on that.
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Well, you're quite right about the first point. One of the problems with the totalitarian period is that it undermines people's respect for the law because they see that the Communist Party or the Fascist Party or whatever doesn't really respect the law, and so why should they do it either? And I think for years after Maoism is gone, that price gets paid in Chinese society. Well, years ago, you remember, David, we had the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, I think it was called, that we would only do certain things with the Soviet Union if they let people come out, Jews and others who were in trouble. And President Carter was president at the time, and Deng Xiaoping came. I met Deng then in Washington, 1979, I believe, and the Jackson-Vanik Amendment came up in terms of how China and the U.S. were going to deal with it. And Deng Xiaoping said to Mr. Carter, no problem in letting Chinese come. How many would you like? 30 million? 40 million? 50 million? Yes, it's nearly a quarter of the world. And one of the questions about the future is... Well, put it this way, is economics destiny for China? Is it this economic development that will make their future? Is politics their destiny that they'll trip up because of the one-party state? Or is culture the destiny that the economic success of China is going to bring a worldwide dominance of Chinese culture? Cultural influence, like with the British Empire, the English language, the Church of England, all this kind of thing, it does ride on the back of power, including naval power. I'm not sure that the Chinese are interested in that, even the party state. And historically, the Chinese dynasties were not very interested in going around the world. The Ming Dynasty had an excellent navy, 14th century to the 17th, but it reached Africa, but it didn't found colonies. I find that very interesting. There has been a certain tendency of Chinese culture to say, okay, we're the best, we know it, you come to us, rather than go around the world and put their flags everywhere. That may change, but I think I would bet against it.
So Chinese foreign policy is more dictated by internal sort of needs and interests as opposed to external aspirations?
Heavily by internal mm-hmm. interests. Controlling the people, controlling those 14 borders with three or four more countries just across the water, and especially the ethnic minorities who have brothers and sisters across the border in sovereign countries.
Does China have any authentic allies abroad beyond states that have a reason to not upset China that might be in the general region?
That's a very interesting point, Chris. China has not been able to hang on to allies. The big one, of course, was the Soviet Union, and Mao split with them, and that changed the world. That's what led to the Nixon-Mao handshake, and a bipolar world turned into a triangle. And looking back, it contributed mightily to the demise of the Soviet Union. But the answer to your question is that North Korea is their only former ally at the moment. And others they have sort of in their pocket, like Burma, Laos to a degree. But I don't think that the Chinese are good at alliances. I don't think they're given to alliances. And I certainly think the one with North Korea is almost as much an albatross for them as it's an impediment to our own efforts to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula.
We have an email here from Ben, who says he's a former student of yours from the days when you were at UT. He says, having lived in Beijing from 2004 to 2006, I noticed huge misunderstandings in the mass media of each country regarding the other. How do you think Americans can foster better understanding of American values among common Chinese who don't have access to many perspectives in their media?
Ben, by doing what you did, go over there and mix with them, and doing what UT also does, which is receive a lot of Chinese students. I think it's almost impossible to overestimate the importance of student exchanges in the future of America-China relations. Beyond that, the internet has transformed China. I remember the days, Ben, when you'd go to China and you couldn't even make a phone call from a hotel without going through the hotel operator and saying who exactly you were calling and why you were calling it. And you certainly couldn't call internationally simply by dialing. And gradually that gave way. In those days, there was no telephone book for Beijing. That was a state secret if you asked for a telephone book.
Would the operator say no if you didn't give a reasonable reason to call someone?
Definitely, but not by saying no. They would just say busy, 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 or it's not a good time to call. That's the way they would do it. But then the fax machine came, and in Tiananmen in 89, the trees were covered with faxes from the Hong Kong press in Chinese characters, but that was the best way the Chinese got some reasonably objective information about what had been happening in their own country. Then, Ben, the cell phone came in and the internet. So technology is marching in the direction that you indicate.
Ross Terrell is a fellow at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard University. He's in town to speak at an event this evening sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more about that at dfwworld.org. Ross, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.